Well, having looked at the questions, there are a few that weren't on the overall schedule events, and if you will permit me, I may, before we start this particular lecture on ethics, there's one area that a number of questions came in on that I would like to speak to, and that is the problem of miscarriage. Very difficult circumstance. I can tell you as an obstetrician and having to face so many women, the statistics that we used early in my practice in the early 80s was about 1 out of 4 pregnancies miscarried. We know it's considerably higher than that now just because of our ability to test. We can now test pregnancies and know that a pregnancy exists even before the period is missed. So that, unfortunately, has just enabled us to know how common the circumstance is. And I can say this, that to the best of my recollection, every woman that I took care of that faced miscarriage, her first question after why was, what did I do to cause it? So let's clarify that. Short of a gunshot or nuclear attack, radiation levels beyond what we could survive, you don't do stuff that causes miscarriage. What little we know is that probably 3/4 of them are caused by a chromosomal abnormality that is incompatible with early life. There are some other issues that we know of, but by and large, some of the wives' tales that you may have heard that need to be also put to rest. Have you heard the one where if you raise your hands over your head, it causes miscarriage? That was one that I heard all the time. Maybe that's just a Texas wives' tale, but trust me, it has nothing to do with an intrauterine pregnancy. Lifting, exercise, flying, all of those issues have no good statistical basis in causing miscarriage. Now, when we alter the hormonal environment with some of these drugs, is it possible that we've improved it enough to allow ovulation but not enough for a good implantation? That's certainly possible. The whole immune system and the immunologic causes for miscarriage, we are just now understanding that there are antibodies to implantation site and a lot of embryo antigens. So we will be learning more about that, and some of the treatment protocols specifically address those things. And one asked, how long after a miscarriage? Statistically, before you try again, statistically, if you conceive the month after a miscarriage, you have a slightly higher miscarriage rate. So most doctors say 3 months, not because there's any great evidence, just that that seems like a good safe period of time. But it, in my mind, in my experience, it's good to allow the body to at least recycle one time, get things back normalized before pursuing either high-tech treatment or if it was an IUI or something else. But that's really a fairly short amount of time, and it's a good time to do the grieving process. Let me just say as an aside that life is a precious life, whether it lasted only far enough to be chemically detectable, whether it lasted for the first trimester, or whether it lasted to mid-pregnancy before death overcame this pregnancy. And I guess a good thing to mention out loud is that men and women approach that a bit differently. Women, being the ones that are pregnant, have a real connection, and it's more than just biological. It's emotional. It's very deep. And husbands don't feel that or see that as well. While they are empathetic and sympathetic towards their wives, they generally don't feel it the same way. And their greater grief is that their wife is hurting. And that can actually cause a distance. Even though it seems like a very noble thing to care about your spouse, it's good to recognize that this is a life that has been jointly created, a life, in my view, with eternal significance that has been lost. So there is a normal grieving process, and you may go through it at different rates, but let me encourage you that that's something that needs to be done. Now, as we move through this section, I may take some little detours to try to pick up some of the questions that you asked. Some very detailed and specific questions. As I was telling Sandy, we've never had quite this assortment, so we'll try to fit it into the time schedule. Since we have teased you with this lovely setup for lunch next door, I would be remiss if I didn't have us there in time. This primarily is to address the intellectual issues of infertility, its diagnosis, its treatment. Is it right? Is it wrong? Can you use it based on your faith system? How do you think through these issues? And let me say at the outset, there are good and godly men and women that disagree over some of these things. So rather than just try to tell you what to think, we're going to look through some ways of how to think through these different procedures, because many people make their judgment in general without even knowing what you're going through. And then maybe we can come to, if not a consensus, at least an understanding that we each have done the hard work of thinking through it and have arrived at a position that is consistent. That's what I look for more than having you agree with me. There are people on this campus, other faculty members, that don't precisely agree with everything. That's fine. And when we talk about ethics, the right and wrong, the good and bad kind of thing, you have to remember that you bring into every circumstance your personal ethics of what you think is right and wrong. There are some legal issues involved as to what is legal and what is not, particularly when we talk about getting drugs from elsewhere and bringing them in. Certain cultural ethics. And this is a good caution. At one of the Christian Medical Dental Society meetings, one of our missionary doctors came back and spoke of the culture where he served in Africa. To be infertile was more than just a bad deal. The infertile woman was considered just a drain on society. She just ate food. She didn't produce anything. So the punishment was stoning. Now, before we make any ethical decisions, are you willing to say that's worth somebody dying over? So as we think through it, I think there are areas where we are confident, maybe some that we are sure, and more of those where I think there's room for some disagreement, considering that life is a wonderful gift. And the children are, in my mind, a great gift. Not the gift, not the only gift of God, but certainly as we put these issues together, that we keep that in mind. So just for a little science, episteme or epistemology is sort of the, how do you know what you know? The theory of knowledge. How can you be sure what you say is right or wrong or moral or immoral? And we live in an interesting time. If you've heard much about postmodern thought, it suggests that there is no absolute truth. That you find for yourself what is true for you, and if it works for you, that's fine. I am not of that school. I think there is some absolute truth. I think there are some areas that are confusing, but I think there are others that are quite clear. I grew up in a time of empiricism and scientism, whereas if you couldn't repeat it in a lab, you couldn't prove it, so you couldn't know it. And if that's your episteme, your theory of knowledge, then you can chunk out humanities, theology, and ethics, because you can't put that to the test in the lab. You can't repeat those kind of things. So I'm of the school that you can know some things that are apart from scientific tests, that there are some areas of morality that we can understand. And so I bring the humanities, theology, and ethics back into the equation of what we can know. So as a theist, that is obviously I'm a Christian, I accept good science. I like to think of myself as a scientist, but I don't accept that that's all we can truly know. I think there is some revealed truth that we can know, that there are moral absolutes, that there are some things that are absolutely wrong. And postmodernists would say that truth, reason, and values are relative to perspective community. So you can see when I sit around an ethics table with folks of a postmodern persuasion, we are going to disagree on some things. And that's pretty well okay with me. Can we disagree agreeably, and am I free to share my thoughts? Am I free to share my convictions, even as I hear what they have to say? So as we look at bioethics, which is now sort of a hot commodity, if any of you follow the stock market, biotechs coming everywhere, new IPOs every day, money flying in and out, everybody's talking about it. Let's see if we can look at what is the morality of healthcare issues, because you find yourself in the midst of it when you're talking about infertility. We'll use this definition for morality, the beliefs and practices of human beings and social institutions about right and wrong behavior and about good and bad character. Most of us think we can do that. How many of you saw the movie Titanic? Good movie, bad movie? Some good, some bad. See, even in this room there's dissension. How many of you were surprised when the boat went down? It's a terrible tragedy to me, but we believe that we can look at a movie or look at a painting or analyze a situation and know what's right or wrong. And what I'd like to suggest is we're going to do that well and intelligently. We sort of need a framework, a grid through which to look at it. So just for these few moments, a little of classroom science for you. These are the four big principal terms of ethics. You need to know them just so you can dazzle and amaze your friends. My students need to know them if they choose to pass the final exam. They're not laughing. That's scary. All right, the first one is beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy, and justice. Wherever you sit discussing ethical issues, these are either the kind of terms or derivations of these terms that you should hear. What are they? Well, beneficence is to do good. So what do you guess non-maleficence is? Don't do bad. Yeah. Let's see if you can all say that. Non-maleficence. Non-maleficence. See, this is a sharp group. All right. Non-maleficence is avoiding harm, which should take you back to the Hippocratic Oath that most doctors at University of Kentucky, we did take that oath upon graduation, apart from the first paragraph. Has anyone ever read it? The first paragraph has an oath to the gods and the goddesses. I mean, it's kind of a pagan oath. But the part about doing good, not doing harm, not doing abortions, not fooling around with your patients, those kind of things that are in there are really quite good and have stood the ethical standard of centuries. Autonomy, respect for the person's self-determination. Now, that can be a huge issue at the end-of-life kind of ethical things. My body, my life, if I want to end it, I should be able to. That's radical autonomy. And then justice, to give to each his right or due. With me so far? All right, because what we're going to do is take some of the procedures and the tests that are involved in reproductive technology and look at them through this grid to see if they are ethical and moral. Generally, ethicists will put these issues under beneficence to do good: confidentiality, veracity, sanctity of life, medical futility, and resource allocation. Once again, I'm going to show you what these are. You don't have to write them down. There is no test after today. Confidentiality is keeping personal information secret. Aren't you hoping your medical people do that? Don't you wish some of your friends would? I mean, has anybody just shared this really deep secret with someone, and before you know it, everyone in the neighborhood is praying for you and doing stuff that, and asking your husband about sperm counts and you about your temperature charts and have you tried this and have you tried that? It goes on and on. That would be unethical. Veracity, that each patient has the right to know the truth about his or her condition. Do you want to be told like it is? If this procedure has a 10% chance of success, do you not want to know that so you can decide whether that expense for that test at that time is something that fits and is consistent with your system? Sanctity of life. Human life is of inestimable value. Every person is worthy of honor. Most will agree with that. The question comes up is, when do we become a person? Where do you become a person legally? What is the legal ethic about personhood? Right, at birth. 1973, January 22nd, Dallas, Texas, Roe versus Wade, which was not primarily about abortion, it was primarily about privacy, but it changed a lot of issues and turned the tide in that direction. That's not our concern for today, other than to suggest that what you decide about when personhood and unique human life begins has all to do with how you feel about sperm, eggs, embryos, frozen, thawed, and how all that works together. So you see, it actually fits. You have to make some decisions as to when this human life is a unique person. The goal, what is it? Can we solve the problem? Should you be on a ventilator forever? That's a key issue also in those end-of-life things. Medical futility is not as key in the infertility issue as resource allocation. Used to be, when I first started, nobody paid nothing for infertility treatment, unless it was endometriosis. And if you give me just a slight detour, because somebody asked me about endometriosis. Endometrium is the tissue that lines the inside of the uterus. It grows in preparation for pregnancy. It sloughs off as the period. That's normal. Estrogen makes it grow. Progesterone makes it ready to implant. Stop the progesterone, period. That's normal. Now, if you have that endometrial tissue in the wrong place, out in the pelvis, on the ovary, on the tube, on the bladder, that's endometriosis. Now, it also grows and tries to slough with every cycle, but it's got nowhere to go, so it causes scarring and sticking, and it causes a very hostile environment because the woman's body starts making antibodies to try to clean up this area, so when the sperm get out there, they're often wiped out even though there's a minimal amount of endometriosis. So endometriosis can be involved in infertility. We grade it minimal, mild, moderate, and severe, and the pregnancy rates are proportional to that. There are some nice therapies, nice from the medical standpoint of, yes, we can do something about them, not necessarily nice if you are the person on the Danicrin or the one who has to have the laser laparoscopy to get rid of it. But that's endometriosis in a nutshell. So how are the healthcare dollars spent? Some things, some procedures, some diagnoses, some insurance companies will cover. But the farther out you get into high tech and in vitro and even micro manipulation and ICSI kind of things, which we'll share briefly because someone asked, they're less and less likely to cover you. Is that reasonable? Is that ethical? Well, thanks to Resolve and others, there's been some noise made about not covering these circumstances. And I think that we as a country need to come to a consensus that some healthcare dollars need to be spent in this arena. Now, it'd be great if everything was smooth and we all agreed and there was never any conflict between issues, but as you will see, there is. And that's when circumstances force a choice between two well-founded opinions. And we are going to have some difference of opinion. And we may come to different ethical constructs, but let's work through it and see if we can see how it fits. Now, there are three main systems. You've got the four principles: beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, and autonomy. These systems, the utilitarian would say, what does the most good for the most people? Resource allocation. We got $100,000. Should I spend $10,000 on this many patients, or should I spend it all on one? Utilitarian would say, well, the most good most people says split it up and spend it with all these folks. Deontology, or duty-based, has to do with law. Is there a law that says you do this or you don't do this? For my Christian worldview, the thou shalt nots pretty well covered those issues. But you may have noticed there are some issues that aren't addressed. In vitro fertilization is not addressed in Scripture, in my view. But I'll show you the way I approach medical ethics, and you can agree or disagree. The virtue-based system is fairly simple. It says, what would a person of virtue do in this situation? Which, for those of you with a Christian worldview, will hear the what would Jesus do in the background, which is perfectly fine. As long as you know who Jesus was and what Jesus would do in the circumstance, you can use that. Otherwise, there are some people who have different faith systems or non-Christians that have a view of virtue that brings them to very similar solutions in a lot of areas. So those are the systems. You've heard the principles. Now let's get back to the myth I showed you, that people of faith are against any assisted reproductive technology. Have you heard that one? Well, you may. I am not one of those people, but there are people that I respect that feel very differently about some of these issues. What I'm going to try to do is explain them to you so that you can make some informed decisions and share with you my system, not to impose it on you, just to see how these things work. All right, the ones against medical intervention often say that God opens and closes the womb. Medical intervention is playing God, and doctors take huge risks with embryos. Is that true? Does God open and close the womb? Certainly. Is there anything that I as a physician can do that will fake out God? I think not. Now, you know, depending on your perception of God, you may view that differently. Is what I do playing God? Not the way I see it. See, when I read what God does, he just speaks it and it happens. My work with drugs and with surgery does not, to me, fit that same kind of bill. Now, when you talk about discarding life and things, now we're getting at a different issue. But if I'm trying to help someone who's got an infection, who's got endometriosis, who's got a thyroid deficiency, and correct that, that to me fits in my medical paradigm. Doctors take huge risks with embryos. The fact is, early in the process, I think they took unacceptably high risk with embryos. I don't think that's true now. I think there are many clinics that take a very high view of life, and I'm very comfortable with the procedures that they are doing in some areas. And I'm hoping as you see this, you'll work out where you think that line may be, where this far it's okay to go, but over that, maybe you're in an area that's not part of our dominion. This is the way I think, that the Bible does speak of some intervention for those who are weeping, for those who are sad, for those who are ill. And I certainly feel strongly about chemotherapy for cancer. My wife is a cancer survivor. One of you asked a question about hormones and breast cancer in particular. Generally speaking, the statistics we have now, it's going to be at least 5 years after treatment and tamoxifen before any kind of replacement therapy or stimulation would be appropriate. That's what we know today. 10 years from now, that may be the worst advice you've ever heard. So I am of the belief that we can use medications for overcoming reproductive ailments, that we can use surgical interventions. My urging to you is to understand the process, to understand the procedures, and then make decisions that are consistent with your ethical system. Know what they're going to do. Know what's going to happen. So I would respond that if you choose to use reproductive technologies, that you'd use them with understanding, that you use them wisely in a way that honors the dignity of life, even at the one-celled stage. Now we've gotten to what is my assessment of when human life begins. We understand a bit of the process. The sperm penetrates the egg, and then when the chromosomes from the sperm and the chromosomes from the egg align, in my view, that's you. You are a unique individual life. From that point on, there's division and growth, but nothing else is added. So from that moment, in my view, we have human life. And so that will now color my ethical decisions from that moment on. I am of the belief that anything that I can do as a physician, I'm a believer in the one flesh principle of marriage, that anything that I can do that help a husband and wife conceive with respect to dignity of life is appropriate for me to pursue. Now, that doesn't mean anything outside that is sin. What, in my view, what's outside that may have some wisdom issues, may have some sin issues, but maybe it's just may or may not be wise, and we'll get to those. All right, you ready now to put the workup through? I've got most of the things you asked me about in here, but if I miss one and there's a procedure that I've confused you with or you don't understand, please, let's make this clear so that you walk out with a good handle on what's going on. Particularly for my pastoral and counseling folks, people will come to you asking your advice as to what they should do. Don't give advice if you don't know what the procedure is. Don't give advice to say a Christian doesn't do that or a Catholic doesn't do that if you don't know what that is. Okay? And recognize that the different faith systems approach this now differently. I've told you about my one flesh principle, but there are those that believe that the unitive and the procreative must be together. That is, the sex act has to be part of the conception act, which will not allow folks of that faith system to use some of these things like artificial insemination and some of the outside the body procedures. That is fine. You can hold that position and be consistent. That's not my... I think that the sex act is hugely important in marriage, but I don't think the key of it is the procreative issue. All right? That's my take and my study of this. There are some good folks that think I'm out to lunch, okay? Maybe it's my personal bias. I love the process of pregnancy. You know, I loved being an obstetrician. And the third of my practice that were dealing with infertility and pregnancy loss, boy, they got all of my blood, sweat, tears, and prayers because it was really, really special to move from that valley to a positive outcome. And, you know, as Julie said, there's a positive outcome for everyone, but it may not be a baby. It may not be your own child. It may not be an adopted child. God may lead you in a direction to minister in a child-free situation. It's a hard valley to walk through, and I never promise anybody how it will turn out. But in my humanity, I want it all to turn out the way people come in wanting it to. All right. Now, there's some stuff on these slides that are current, being used now, and I even put some stuff on there that's controversial that not everybody uses. And then there's some new stuff on there that's not even all that new anymore. And there, I promise you, there'll be some stuff in a year's time that we don't even know about now. So we need an ethical system that will help us think through it. So when somebody says, can I do that? You have a frame of reference to answer. Basal body temperature. Anything unethical about a woman taking her temperature every morning before she gets out of bed to watch for the progesterone surge? Of course not. That was a simple one. They get way harder than that. LH surge. You're looking for the little LH peak. That's a pituitary hormone that shoots the messenger down to the ovary. And when it peaks and you turn pink or blue, depending on which kit you buy, you know that 24 hours later, with a very small window of fudge factor, ovulation should occur. Anything wrong with that? Does it violate any marital principle? Does it violate any ethical principle? Does it violate sanctity of life? No. You see, you're becoming ethical experts now. Progesterone levels. We know that if the progesterone level in a woman after ovulation isn't sufficiently high for long enough, she may miscarry. So we might check the progesterone to be sure she's ovulated, and if it's low, we might replace it with shots, pills, suppositories. There's all sorts of ways you can replace it. Anything unethical about trying to stabilize the hormone environment. All right. Serial ultrasound. And I must tell you now, from the obstetrician's perspective, this was the hottest thing since sliced bread. Once we could follow the ovaries in their maturation, we really felt like we could tell what was going on. And we used to have to do it with the abdominal sono, Any of you remember that, where you had to fill your bladder till you're about to explode and then go in and have somebody rub the sono on you? It was awful, but we could watch to see if maturation was taking place. Then came the transvaginal sono, which I won't claim is comfortable, but it's incredibly accurate. You don't have to have a full bladder, and we can watch with great precision the follicles mature. So we know, is this level of Clomid working? Is this level of Pergonol working too well? What's going on? And it's wonderful because it allows us to time things well and to better understand it. This is an observation procedure. Anything unethical about it? No. I think we use sono for all sorts of things. We can scan your thyroid. They'll scan my heart on Monday with sound wave. That's what ultrasound is. Wonderful test. Don't think there's a big ethical issue there. If you believe that it is okay for medicine to get involved in the area of reproduction. If you're of the school that it's God's thing, and I am of the school it's God's thing. I just happen to think that he has entrusted us with some knowledge and some insight and some ability that we are entitled to use if we use it wisely. All right, we've done the ovary side. Now let's do the man side. Semen analysis, sperm count, motility, morphology. We can tell all sorts of things about sperm. We can tell stuff about sperm we don't even know what to do with. You know, double-headed, spinning sideways, running in circles. Just watching them is amazing because only about 14-15% are normal. Heading the right way, know what they're doing. The rest of them are just lost. I mean, they're just lost. Any ethical issues with semen analysis? Warning, trick question. Okay, what is the ethical issue with semen analysis? Yes, the collection of the specimen, masturbation. Because for some, masturbation involves lust in the mind, which would be a sin, which would then ethically be immoral. And some clinics have the specimen collection room, which is a room with magazines and movies to entertain and delight so that the man can get his specimen. I have a little ethical problem with that. Is there any way to get the specimen for a semen analysis without violating that? Absolutely. If his imaginations are toward his wife, if she helps him get the specimen, I think there's no, in my view, you have not then crossed an ethical barrier. For some, they use a specialized condom that can collect the specimen and bring it in. It's not as good because the latex in the condom, it's a plastic actually, changes the motility slightly, but not enough to really throw the test off. So my suggestion is if you know what you're doing, there may be a way, I think that this test can be done. Now I put the hamster on there just for fun. The hamster egg penetration test, a personal favorite of mine. There are those who swear by it, those who swear at it, as in terms of its value as a test. But what it does is it exposes a hamster egg to human sperm to see if the sperm has the right enzyme component to penetrate the egg. Any ethical problem with that? The question is, what do you get? We used to say you'd get a first-year med student, but nobody thought that was very funny. What do you get? Nothing. You just find out if it penetrates. There's no chromosome alignment. I don't have a sanctity of life issue. That's not it. The problem with the test isn't that. It's just it's not really predictable. You know, I like a test that actually tells me something. This test, some men can penetrate the hamster egg but don't penetrate the human egg. And some men can't penetrate the hamster egg but are fertile and penetrate the human egg. So while it is helpful, and some people really like it, the fudge factor where you're not sure is large enough that, you know, if you haven't had this test, don't go call on your doctor and say, hey, where's the hamster? Okay? But it's perfectly fine to say, what do you think about the hamster egg penetration test? And depending on where you are in the United States, as I say, some will say, oh, love that one. And some will say, that's fine for hamsters, but it doesn't work. Okay? That's the way medical science is. It's not yes or no. Now, the Sims-Huener, the post-coital test, I'm not going to ask if anyone's had this, but just smile. Is there a worse test in the world, you think? We schedule intercourse and then have you race to the doctor's office so we can see if the sperm and the mucus are compatible. Imagine that, being told when to perform and then being told how well you did. But what it tells us is how does the sperm and the mucus interact? Is there a lot of white blood cells, pus cells, infection kind of thing in the mucus or in the sperm? Are they compatible? Sometimes that's the first clue that maybe there's an antibody situation there. There may be some sperm antibody in the mucus. But once again, it's not 100%. It's got a broad overlap where you flunk the Huener's but you're pregnant, Or you pass the Hunters with flying colors, but you can't, that's not the answer. So some offices use this on everybody, and some offices don't use it at all. That's why it has the star. It's got studies that say this is great, and there are studies that say this is worthless. And so at this point in time, we're not sure. I thought it was reasonably helpful. I tried not to overdo it because I realized what a horrible test, you know, it was on the patient. But if it was really good, if it's a really good test, the mucus is clear as a bell, real stretchy, sperm flying through there without a hitch, that made me think I can move on to the next step. But if it was kind of in between, it didn't help because I didn't know if it was just in between or if it was really showing me something. So I'd either have to repeat it or do some other tests. Anything ethically troublesome about the Sims Hunter? Husband, wife, I mean, it's a nuisance. I mean, but I'm not sure that I have can throw a real ethical wrench in there. Ultrasound, we've talked about. Hysterosalpingogram, that's a dye test that shows us what the shape of the uterus is. Are the tubes open? Will the dye pass all the way through? I could have put a star by that one because you can have a normal hysterosalpingogram that the dye does come out the tubes, but the tubes aren't normal. They're kind of glued together. The dye comes out, but there's fertility is not going to happen. So you can get false assurance there. But it's another piece of the puzzle that if it's normal and this is normal, I move on. But the laparoscopy, the telescope where we generally put it in the belly button and actually look around at the pelvis, that is the diagnostic test that shows us the most. That's where you can find endometriosis. You can think that you have it, but you can't know that you have it till you've looked at it. And I wouldn't treat you for endometriosis unless I knew that you had it. You can also put dye through the tubes during that test, a little blue dye called chromoperturbation, and it's nice to see it bubble through. You can see the little fimbria, the little fingers on the ends of the tubes, see if they're nice and delicate and fragile and normal in color. It's just a beautifully helpful test to determine what the anatomy is like inside. Is there any ethical problem with a diagnostic test such as that? See, I don't think so. So we've already gone a pretty far away in diagnostics without having a major ethical glitch. We talked a little about hormone evaluation. See, all of this is involved. If the estrogen-progesterone ratio is not right, that's correctable. If the thyroid's too low, pregnancy's not going to happen. It needs to be correctable. If the prolactin is too high, pregnancy's not going to be happen. Not going to happen. It needs to be lowered into the normal range. Androgens are the male hormones. Women are supposed to have them. But if you have too many, as in polycystic ovary disease and some adrenal kind of things, it can throw the delicate balance out that's required for conception. And so correcting, you evaluate them, blood tests, all of them are blood tests, all of them are expensive, and then you can make adjustments to try to get the hormonal environment appropriate. All of this kind of stuff usually happens pretty early once you start the process. The sperm and the egg thing you do first, and then you kind of work your way through. You work through in a big hurry if you're 35, 38, 40. You can work through a little slower if you're 28, 32, and in that range. And now we'll get to the treatments. Now that I hope you understand the diagnostics, we can look about what we can do. Any problems with correcting the thyroid or correcting the prolactin level or correcting the estrogen level in the woman? You think that's ethical? I do too, and that's a high-tech treatment. How about ovulation induction, where I use Clomid or Pergonol to try to make the woman ovulate or even multiple ovulate? We don't have the confidence we used to have out there. I think we can still do that. There are some risks and benefits that need to be explained to the patient, the side effects of the drugs, the hyperstimulation possibilities. But that's a risk benefit that the patient can choose to take, and that there's no sanctity of life issue. There's no marital issues involved. This is still trying to get things into the normal parameters. The surgical treatments as opposed to diagnosis. When I would do a laparoscope, I could also hook in scissors, lasers, clips, all sorts of stuff to rearrange and correct what you find. If you find endometriosis, you can blast it. I mean, you can vaporize it with a laser. So when you finish, endometriosis visible is gone. Could there be some microscopic? Yes. Is there a person? Yeah, a third will come back in 3 to 5 years. But that's a nice window with no endometriosis, if that was the cause. Microscopic surgery, we restored tubes, repaired tubes, open tubes, particularly with bad endometriosis or previous pelvic infection. A ruptured appendix can spill stuff, and then when the woman gets into childbearing years, the tubes can be all glued up, and a microscopic approach may be the appropriate. All that is restoring anatomy. Ethical problems? Now, you see, if you buy into my system, these all make quite good sense as interventions. If you're allowed to intervene at all, these seem very in keeping and consistent with the system. Now it gets more interesting. Insemination. Let's say for some reason or other, the sperm is not getting to the egg. Can I do insemination with the husband's sperm? Insemination just means to inject it either in the uterus, or in the old days we'd put it in the vagina when we didn't know how to wash the sperm so as to put it up inside the uterus. A little more problematic for some of you? Is it because of the unitive procreative thing? Because now the sex act is separate from the effort at conception? If that is your school of thought, then you would not be able to go in this direction. If you think that this is a treatment for a sperm problem, motility or numbers, then you could use husband sperm. I feel like this fits my system. It may not fit yours. What about donor egg or donor sperm? This is where you can usually part the Red Sea, and people will come down on different issues. Early in my practice, I used donor insemination. I did donor insemination. But as I thought through the issues for myself and the one flesh issue in a marriage, I chose not to do that. But I'm not convinced that it's sin. I think it's a wisdom issue. I'm not sure that bringing in a third-party gametes is necessarily wise. I do not think that it is adultery. You may hear that places, but I understand adultery. Adultery involves the mind. Because if someone has sex with someone else and there is no sperm, sperm's not the issue. If someone is raped, they've not committed adultery. They've had a crime committed on them. So it's a willing giving of oneself to the sexual act that has to do with adultery. And let me just say that in insemination, that's not what's happening. That is not what's going on in there. So while I feel like husband insemination fits my paradigm, donor insemination is a questionable area for me, I would not say, boy, that's sin. That's black and white adultery. I think it is that adultery is not what that issue is. All right? But you have your ethical system now, and you can choose to disagree. Hyperstimulation just means juicing up the ovary so there's lots of eggs. And then in IUI is intrauterine insemination, where we spin and wash the sperm. And if for me it was the husband's sperm spin and washed and injected, that's okay in my system. If you have the unitive procreative position, you could not use that because the unitive is not part of the procreative act. Now, with donor, it's the same issue for me. It's a wisdom issue. It's not necessarily a sin issue. This is where a lot of people need to think through their ethics as to why they think you can or can't do that. And that's what I urge you to do, because you'll find some people right there that go, well, I couldn't do that. That's fine. Why is that? Well, I think that the whole thing of reproducing between us works, but not with a third person involved. That's fine. Or you may feel like that bringing somebody else in that anonymous sort of fashion, and recognize that anonymous sort of fashion is a changing target these days, because what used to be sealed records is quickly becoming open records, such that someone who donated anonymously to the frozen sperm bank can be found out. And you see, that's where I think the wisdom of the ethics may be problematic, because then you have people drawn in that had no idea they were going to be drawn into this situation. They were not told the truth. I mean, when they were promised this is an anonymous donation, now 20 years later, it's no longer anonymous. So they've put themselves in an ethical quagmire. But that's not the same to me as thus saith the Lord. I don't think that it's that clear. I told you this would get interesting. It gets more so. For the sake of time, we're going to have to pick up the pace a little. Does everybody know the alphabet soup, gift, zift, and IVFET? Maybe. All right, well, GIFT is gamete intrafallopian transfer, where they take the sperm and the egg, put them in a syringe, and inject it into the tube. So fertilization takes place out in the tube where it's supposed to, travels 3 or 4 days in the tube, and then implants after 3 or 4 days in the uterus. Now, in my ethical system, if you take husband's sperm and wife's egg, is GIFT ethical? Good. Whether you agree or not, at least you understand the consistency of the system. ZIFT is zygote intrafallopian transfer, where they let the sperm and the egg meet out in the petri dish. Conception has occurred. Then they take that conception and shoot it into the tube, and the process continues. If you will grant me the sperm from husband and egg from wife, is ZIFT ethical in my construct? Yes, it still is. IVFET talks about fertilizing the eggs ex utero, and then embryo transfer is taking them from the dish and putting them back into the woman. If you give me the husband's sperm, the wife's egg, and you fertilize two eggs, and you put both two back into the uterus, is IVFET consistent with my system? Okay, yes it is. Now, we've handled the simple stuff. What if we fertilize 15 eggs and we put back four? What happens to the other 11? What happens now? Sometimes they're frozen, cryopreservation. And so then you have frozen embryos in a refrigerator and in a appropriately temperature controlled. In my ethical system, what do I now have frozen in the fridge? Right. In my view, you have human life there. For those who decide that personhood begins later, either at implantation or brainwaves or heartbeat, they may not have the same ethical problem I do with cryopreserved embryos. But my feeling for cryopreserved embryos is they're people. And so they need to either be reimplanted in that person or reimplanted as an adopted embryo. If that is the case, then you have made an ethical decision with what I think is an ethical problem, but not necessarily a sin issue. You with me? Okay, because you need to think through that, because I think if you choose the in vitro route and you are of a Christian worldview, I think you can do that, but you have to do some controls. You have to know how many eggs are being fertilized and where they're going to go. I don't think you can allow your fertilized eggs to just disappear. Wisdom for me is to fertilize the ones you're going to reimplant and not have those ethical issues. I understand that's more expensive, because if they don't take, then you got to do the whole process again next month instead of just taking the frozen embryos and reimplanting them. And let me tell you, I have delivered babies that came from frozen embryos. I think that's a good solution once you have them frozen. But we now face hundreds of thousands of embryos that are frozen, particularly in Great Britain. I don't know exactly the number here. And nobody knows what to do with them. We should have thought that through beforehand in my ethical system. Now, micromanipulation is remarkable. It is slick. This is not what I did. I was OB-GYN infertility. I took it up to the Pergonol and then referred to the reproductive endocrinologist. When I started, there was no such animal. This has developed in the last decade. What they can do now is take an egg and do some pretty slick things with it. ICSI is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which means I can take one sperm, load it up into a syringe, pop the egg, and inject it in. That is remarkable, and it has quite a decent success rate. And what happens once the sperm is in and the chromosomes align? You have a person. So in my view, as long as you treat that with dignity and respect, I am of the school, husband-wife, that micromanipulation works. If you're going to use donor gametes, and you can get sperm from here and eggs from here, put them together here, put them in this woman, give the baby to this woman. Yes, you can do all of those things. Is it wise? And that's what we need to think through. ICSI, husband-wife, trying to do that because the sperm count's real low. Used to be we couldn't do much for male infertility. But with ICSI, you can do it with just a minimal number of sperm. In fact, I had a gentleman who had basically no vas deferens. There was no connection from the testicle up. He was making sperm, but they weren't getting anywhere. We were able to biopsy the testis, get the sperm, and have a baby that way. Now, is that unitive procreative? No. It's high tech. But does it fit my ethical system? It fits mine. It may not fit yours. I just want you to understand the process. Bless you, wherever that was from. Assisted hatching. I just have to mention this briefly. Do y'all know that human eggs have shells? You laugh. They do. They're not like the chicken egg. It's not calcified and hard. But it's a little thicker layer. And the older a woman gets, the thinner layer, more fertile eggs seem to ovulate first, leaving a little tougher ones at 40, 42, 44, 45. And sometimes, what they need is assisted hatching, which is to just scratch that egg, to score it so that as the cells divide, it can burst forth. I just find that fascinating. What is the intent of the reproductive technologists in these situations? Live-born baby. Is that a good intent? In my view, it is. So you have to watch some of these ethical things, because otherwise you can get in a circumstance where you reimplant 6 or 7, and then bam, you've got a family that really wanted to have children, and now they've got sextuplets or octuplets, and this woman's 4'11", and there is no way she can carry this pregnancy. You've created an ethical dilemma that I think wisdom would have avoided. Once you're in that situation, then I think you do the best you can do in that situation. But what can happen, got some. Oh, thank you, Ken. He even anticipates when I'm out of water. Any problem with cryopreserving sperm? Thank you. No. Any problem with cryopreserving eggs? The only real problem with it is we hadn't been able to figure out how to thaw them well. They would be destroyed in the process. Now we're getting better because we understand if you take out the cytoplasm and put in some stuff that freezes better, there will come a time, I hope, where you can have the sperm frozen and the egg frozen. I don't have an ethical problem with that. When you put them together and you have embryos, then in my view, you've got a person, and you have to make good ethical decisions from there on so that you don't have multifetal pregnancy reduction, which is a nice way of saying this woman who's always wanted to be pregnant now has 4 babies, and the doctor says we have to destroy 2. That's awful to try to put somebody through that. Or selective reduction, where you feel like this baby's growing faster than this in a multi-setup, and it's better for this one if we take out. I'm not sure those are the kind of decisions I want to be making. And part of that's because I think human life is of great value, even if it's less than perfect. Even if the chromosomes aren't the star football player or the opera aria, it's a life worthy of living. It's a life worthy of protection. And I think we are entrusted as human beings to care for those that are less than perfect. I know that may not be a popular view, but so these are issues in my mind that you can, if you know what you're doing, you don't have to be in this situation, which is way better than being in it and trying to make a good call there. There were a number of questions on micromanipulation and cryo. Did I cover those for who asked those? This stuff is not cheap, by the way. You know, while you can get thyroid enough to correct the situation for probably $10 or $15 a month, if you're going to go IVFET, you're talking $15,000 to $25,000 a month. And you go micromanipulation, that's higher. Just ballpark. How much of that do you suppose the insurance company will cover? I wouldn't say it's always zero, but it's always close. These are expensive, high-tech things, and to watch somebody, to watch an egg doctor do their thing, it's incredible. I just stand in awe of the things that God has permitted us to do. But it needs to be done with, in my view, reverence and dignity to life. Surrogacy, traditional, gestational. The traditional surrogate involved inseminating a volunteer woman with the sperm of the husband, generally, and she would carry the pregnancy to term. Any ethical issues there? I think there are several. One, you have to decide on the one flesh concept. One, you have to decide on the insemination concept. Then you have the gestation, or the traditional surrogate is now carrying this child, and what may happen? Yeah, there's the legal ethics of what happens to this child when it's born if the mom that's carrying the child and has half of the genetic component wants to keep the child. So there's some huge wisdom issues there that need to be worked through. What's a gestational surrogate? Right. If I were to take the frozen embryos over, we somehow, apparently in my mind, we have a refrigerator over there now. If I were to take those cryopreserved embryos and put them in someone else, they would be a gestational surrogate. Ethical problems with that? Maybe, maybe not. What if the only other option for those embryos was to thaw and die? Then if I, as a woman, want to volunteer to carry that child and raise that child, is that not an ethical solution? Oh, my. See how complicated it gets. I think that this, now we have an ethical problem, and that if someone is willing to adopt the embryo, we have an ethical solution. But it, you know, embryo adoption is something that at this point in time, I think is what we need to understand and maybe pursue for all these embryos that have been created already. Not as a new way to have babies, but as an ethical solution to what will likely happen is they will just be discarded. They will be allowed to thaw and live out their natural lives. What does that mean? An embryo in a dish has no life. It doesn't have a chance. I mean, it is alive. It has no chance at growing, at least at where we are now. All right. Well, this has been a trip through many of the things that are possible and available, certainly not all. And there are some resources that are available. We've already mentioned the internet. In fact, we have been asked, Sandy and I, by iBelieve.com to write a regular column starting in April to address lots of different issues. I hope they'll let you all send questions so you can say, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard, or bring some light on the circumstance. There are some books, seminars like this. We want to get the word out to the caring folks, the pastors and the counselors, as well as to the folks in treatment, that there are resources, that you're not alone, and that there's help for you. There were some of the questions that related to finding a doctor. And I can only speak to the community where I served in Dallas until I get up here. Most of the OB-GYNs that you know, at least in my community, knew where to send you. They knew where the good clinics were. If not, if you're new in town, then resources like Resolve might be a good place to go. When you network with patients, you'll quickly find who are the good doctors who have no bedside manner, who are absolutely brilliant, whose office staff will never return the calls. The kind of things that make this very hard experience better is to find a whole staff that gets it, that will work with you. And if you move up the ladder to IVFET, you better find out what the ethical system of that clinic is and if they're willing to work with yours. Most of them are. You are the patient. I don't want to call it a consumer, but you have some control over that kind of circumstance. And which is better, GIFT or ZIFT or IVFET? The answer is, whatever that clinic does the most and does regularly, that's probably what they are best at. You don't want to go to a GIFT clinic and say, well, what I want is something else, because then you're taking them out of the comfort zone. The statistics are really quite good at a good clinic in most of those areas. One of the questions that the doctor was asked was about turkey basters. You're all supposed to laugh at that. It was one of the questions. Will a turkey baster work for insemination? Yes, it will. I've delivered babies that were the result of turkey basters. I don't recommend it, but there are some couples that have real trouble with erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, and the only way they can get the sperm to the right place is using a turkey baster and or a syringe. I mean, turkey baster was what grandmas used to say, well, just let me borrow the turkey baster. I don't know what you do with it after. I probably don't want to know. But just to answer the question, sure, but what's the underlying issue? One was asked about the environmental things. What are we doing to ourselves to decrease our fertility rate? Because the fact is the population is becoming more infertile over the last 20 to 30 years. My observations would be, one is sexually transmitted disease. Certainly that's gone up. Certainly that's an issue. Two, putting off childbearing. Lots of women have gone to school and gotten degrees and started careers. And that's fine, except that it has given endometriosis a chance to go from minimal to mild to severe. So when they start trying, sometimes they're in a whole different category than those who tried when they were 17 to 21. But that doesn't explain it all. I suspect that there is something, air, water, additives, anything but chocolate cookies. I'm quite confident that those are safe. But we won't know for a generation. We'll probably find out that some of the stuff that we thought was nonsense maybe would have been wiser to use. So take good care of your health, as Sandy said. Eat well. But, giving up Pepsi is not going to be the answer. But eat well, rest well, exercise. That's good for you anyway, because the hormonal environment is a delicate balance in a woman. The temperature issues in a male are more important. If he's a big-time marathon runner, biker, just likes to go to the health club and sit in the hot tub, it can change sperm counts and motility. And it takes 3 months to go from a bad count to a good count if it was just temperature related. So those are the simple pieces of information that your doc ought to be kind of telling you right up front at the beginning to see if that's part of your lifestyle. You know, if husband had the mumps right at puberty and had an orchitis, an infection of the testes, that's something the doc needs to know, because that would push you further ahead to checking that out. Postcoital reliable, we talked about that, endometriosis. Infertility and singlehood. That's a good question. There are some women who have a calling to have children that are still single. Some of them are single by choice. Some of them are single by circumstances. Some of them come from a long family history of endometriosis, and here they are at 25 and not married yet, and wondering, should I be doing something to protect my fertility for later? And in some of those instances, I would recommend certain kind of treatments to try to stretch out the fertility window. If the question was specifically addressed to should single women or single men have children outside of marriage, I think it's a wisdom issue for me. It has to do with the one flesh principle and the sense that under the best of circumstances, a husband-wife home is ideal. Now, we know of husband-wife situations that aren't ideal. We know of single moms and single dads that by life circumstances are raising children and doing a great job. I'm not trying to cast aspersions at that. I'm talking about some of the high-tech kind of things. Would I recommend IVF-ET? In my ethical system, that would be a wisdom issue that I probably wouldn't go there. But if she came to me pregnant, as many single women did, I try to give them the very best of care and support and hook them up with resources so they can do well and have the kind of community, family resources that the church ought to provide, that the community may provide, so that this single mom or single dad and her child or children have you know, the kind of love and encouragement that gets them on the right road. Now, that may not have answered the question as asked, but hopefully that addressed it pretty well. Now, we're going to take better than a break. We're going to move into that fine, fancy room next door and have what should be a wonderful meal. We will reconvene here at about 1:30. If you give me just a moment, let me offer a brief prayer for lunch, and then mix and match, maybe with the group of three that you met. Now they're friends, and enjoy the time together. The bookstore is down the hall. The bathrooms, you know where they are, and we'll be back here at 1:30. Reality is being talked about everywhere. I mean, you can get it on Oprah every day at 4. But their view of the, you know, spirituality means different things to different people. So we're going to talk a little about that, and then Sandy's going to conclude by applying some of those ideas through a biblical framework. We are not suggesting that this is an easy problem, nor that coming to this conference has solved all of those questions for you. This is tough. Life is tough when you factor in the medical expenses, and I'll bet some of those lunchroom tables had some doctor encounters that would have made what little hair I have left fall out. But most of my colleagues are just doing their best. They're in medicine because they care. Good men and women that have dedicated themselves to this, and sometimes it doesn't work out. I imagine my handwriting. I wrote a prescription for dexamethasone for a lady that had too high androgens, and the pharmacist filled it at 10 times what I wrote, or what I thought I wrote. I looked at the script, and it looked clear to me, but that patient got bad medicine, and that patient was mad at me, and she had every right to be. Though I hadn't written the wrong prescription, it worked out badly. So some of your encounters, I hope, were accidental. I'd hate to think that somebody did some of the things that happened. Insurance hassles, on the other hand, those are intentional. I tell you what, both from the patient perspective and the doctor perspective, Jane and I, when as patients trying to get things through as a doctor, we had to hire a whole new person just to spend all day doing insurance stuff. So the hassle is enormous. The relationship, hopefully we've talked some about that. If we have warned you that you will approach these problems differently, man and wife, and maybe encourage you that it's okay maybe to sit and talk about these things, we've done well. We hope to accomplish that, because there are some men that they'll talk about anything but this. There are some women that won't talk about anything but this during that time. That's okay, but healthy is to break a little bit of that wall down and start to maybe share a little more of yourself, because you know it's important to your partner. Well worth it, even if you don't get it or why it's so global or so file drawer, it's just to cover that. I have tried to encourage the men to understand that if your wife is on this hormonal stuff, boy, that's the time to be just full of grace and empathy, because it is tough. It is hard to not know what your body's doing and not know what you're feeling and to be crying over nothing or what would seem to be. And we won't even talk about what happens at the doctor's office. The guys ought to go sometimes just to see what you go through. and understand what a sono, what the sono is like and what all that process is. None of it is pleasant. It's not the same as going and having a stethoscope on your chest and listen to somebody listen to your, you know, listen to your heart beating. It's just a lot more invasive and uncomfortable, and if your ovaries are hyperstimulated and your hormones are flying, it's just a tough deal. So we finished the way we started, is trying to put the whole person together for the pastoral and counseling standpoint, to think of people not as a disease or a disease process, but a person that is facing a trial. And in this conference, we've been looking at a very specific one. But let me share with you just some of the statistics that we use at the Christian Medical Dental Society conferences that we do to encourage doctors to incorporate their faith in their practice, because patients are very open to that if it's dealt with respect and with permission. But 98% of people believe the Bible's a good book. 94% believe in God of some sort. And there's a lot that are influenced by religion. And half of the patients surveyed wish their doctor would pray for them. And I can tell you that before surgery, I've never been turned down when offered to pay for a patient going, or pray for a patient going in. Probably pay for them too. That'd probably be even better. But prayer is generally an important thing. So what we don't want you to do is separate this part of life, which is a very intimate personal part, from who you are as a spiritual and eternal being. So my part of this is just very quickly, because of time, to just remind you of some of the things about God, the God that most people say they believe in, at least in some sense, and taking from Scripture that most people believe, if not inspired and authoritative, which I believe, at least take it as a good book, that God is eternal. And just to kind of think through some of those things. Eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Just some nice biblical pictures for you. It's all powerful. Power belongs to God. He's infinite. Now, I'm not beginning to suggest that I can comprehend the length and breadth and depth of some of these statements. I think it's good for us to ponder them and realize that it is God who is these things and not me. With God, all things are possible. I wish it were just the things that I wanted, that life was fair in the direction I wanted it to be. But as an old Calvin and Hobbes cartoon says, life isn't fair, and it's not that we really want fair, we just want it fair in our direction. Does anybody remember Calvin and Hobbes, or is it, you seminary people think of Calvin as John Calvin and all that stuff? Let me tell you, never mind. God is holy. That's one of my favorites. You know, it's I, the Lord your God, am holy. And he calls us to be holy, which is separate and set apart from selfishness and self-centeredness and to God, a relationship with God that then flows out into a relationship with others. That's the advantage of good support groups. It's a fellowship of spirit and soul that can be encouraging, that can be comforting, that can bear one another's burdens, as Scripture says. And this is one of those burdens that's really hard to bear alone. And it's really hard to bear as a couple. But what you've heard through the day is some folks aren't really burden bearers, but are themselves burdens and kind of jump on. That's tough. It's nice if you can find some folks that'll walk through you with it and help you along the way. He is just. That's not necessarily my favorite. I like grace better. I don't want precisely what I deserve, but it's nice to know that part of God's character is. It all works out in the sovereign divine plan. I don't see it all. I don't even get it all. But his ways are justice, God of truth and without injustice. Righteous and upright is he. He's merciful. He makes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. His mercy endures forever. There's some wonderful biblical pictures, both in the Old Testament Hebrew chesed and the New Testament agape, of a God that loves sacrificially, selflessly, unconditionally, eternally. It's just good to think about sometimes who God is, because it is not because of our merit or that we are worthy and deserving. It is not a reflection of our greatness, but his, that he would love us as he does. He is all wise. The King, eternal, immortal, invisible, God only is wise. And I would be remiss if we didn't talk just briefly and remind you about the God kind of love, and the love that was of such a magnitude that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him would not perish but have eternal life. Perhaps the most popular verse, one that you even see on signs in football games and so forth. And sadly, that familiarity can breed an insulation or almost a callousness to the magnitude of that sacrifice. It's who he is. What's he done? Well, in my view, he's made it. He's created it. He spoke the world into creation. There's a lot of that I don't get, but it's fun to watch my scientific friends as the more they study, the more they find out. This all started sort of one point in time, somehow, somewhere. And, you know, you may like the Big Bang deal. I like the God said it and it happened. It makes sense to me. The Bible says that God sustains it, that if he didn't hold it together, it would all fall apart. And it's good to know that that's not on my shoulders to do. He's a redeemer. And that word may not be familiar to all of you. It means he purchased you from your enslavement to self and sin and a path other than his own. He did that at the high cost of his son so that he could be a holy and righteous judge, not forgetting sin, but judging sin in a substitute that was eternal and worthy, namely Jesus Christ. So this was from a cartoon, actually, but it was so compelling that I thought I would put it up here for you, and Sandy and I have used this recently. It's just to help you think. Two people stargazing, and they ask the question, I wonder, if God is out there, has he spoken? I wonder if he'd visit our planet. If he visited, I wondered what we would do. And I wonder what he would do in return. Depending on your background, we're entering the spring season and the Easter resurrection time, which is a time when many of the religions of the world will celebrate special things. Well, obvious for us, this was the demonstration of love, the resurrection that we point to and celebrate, proof positive that the penalty that was paid by Jesus Christ was accepted by God the Father, and that salvation and forgiveness is available in him. Now, you may not sense that. You may believe differently. My challenge to you, much as in the ethical arena, is to just study the text. Read, think, pray, and seek that part of your spirit that I believe is connected in an eternal sense with the one who desires to reveal himself as one who loves you infinitely. So I said at the beginning that I thought our problem with conception and childbirth is one that relates to a biblical issue. Why is it that a horse can give birth to a colt in 45 minutes and the average woman takes 12 to 14 hours and it hurts? I think it has to do with the fall. I don't think it has to be that way. I think it's that way because it draws us back to an appreciation to our Creator. And I think the pain in conception and the problems related, as you know, make you ask all the why questions, all the deep spiritual questions, appropriately so. Sometimes we have answers, and sometimes we don't. So, Sandy, why don't you come up and take us from here?